casting rods and fished for spot-tail bass, flounder, and sheep's head in the incoming tide. "There's no animal you can't eat," I said one morning as Leah pulled a spot-tail bass onto the shore. "You can eat this fish raw if you need to."
"I don't need to," she said. "I'll never need to."
"How do you know?"
"I'll be like you when I grow up," she said. "I'll have credit cards."
I laughed. "Listen to me, I'm very serious. You can eat insects, turtle eggs. You could eat a loggerhead turtle if you had to. Frogs, raccoons, possums. The world of protein's a large and varied one."
"Makes me want to throw up," she said.
"You never know what's going to happen," I said. I thought about this for a moment before I went on. "Something terrible happens in everybody's life, something out of the ordinary. I'm trying to raise you to be light on your feet, to be on your toes at all times, ready for the unexpected. You won't be able to prepare for it. It'll always take you by surprise. Like my mother. She finally divorces my drunken, worthless father, marries a nice man, then gets rabbit-punched from behind with leukemia. It comes at night when you're sleeping, when your guard is down."
"You shouldn't call your father worthless," Leah admonished. "It's not nice."
"You're the first kid I ever met who could make me feel immature," I said.
"You're mean to your daddy," she said, not looking at me. "All of you are."
"He's also drunk all the time."
"Maybe that's what happens to lonely people."
"You don't know what you're talking about."
"He visits me at school during lunchtime," Leah said. "He's always nice to me, and he's never drunk. He's very sweet, Daddy, and I know he wishes you liked him better."
"I wish I liked him better, too."
Leah said, "It's your job to like him. He's your daddy."
"You're awfully bossy for someone in elementary school."
"You taught me to be nice to everyone," she answered.
"Let me amend that slightly," I said. "Be nice to everyone except my father." Leah shook her head sadly. "You're a bad son. All my uncles are, except John Harden. He loves everybody."
"John Harden doesn't count," I said.
"You don't understand John Harden," she said, "just like you don't understand your daddy."
"You're getting awfully big for your britches."
"Why? I'm glad I'm grown up. Don't you like it?" she asked.
"Not at all. If the truth be known, I'd like to keep you exactly at this age for the rest of your life. I adore you at this exact time of your life. I like being around you 10 times as much as I like being around any other person on Earth. Though it might seem strange to you, I like you better than anyone else I've met on the planet Earth. But like's not strong enough a word. How about adore, worship, plumb nuts about, insane over?" Nothing quite cuts it.
One should never underestimate the power of good teaching, but even bad teaching can have a strong effect. Delia Sinus taught South Carolina history for over 40 years to the 9th graders of Waterford and squelched any passion for history that was budding in the imaginations of her students. There was no area of the subject that she could not render paralyzingly dull. The text was as dry as a logarithm chart, and her high-pitched, one-toned voice could induce stupor in the most hardened insomniac. It was one of the town's rites of passage to fall asleep in Mrs. Sinus's history class. Her week-long lecture on the Siege of Charleston was so tedious that some students left her class never realizing the siege had ended. Mrs. Sinus almost grew faint with delight on the first full day of classes in 1962 when she announced to her class that 2 descendants of some of the most distinguished names in South Carolina history were on her roll of students. She had Capers Middleton and Jordan Elliott stand up to be admired for the good taste they had displayed by being born into such notable families. Capers stood up tall and proud. His face had a chiseled beauty even in the 9th grade. But Jordan arose scowling and disoriented in those new surroundings, with the other kids regarding him with suspicion as a transfer student with strange ties to royalty. On the following day, Jordan was tossed from class when he was caught placing wads of juicy fruit, to which Delia Sinus was famously allergic, behind the map of colonial South Carolina. Mrs. Sinus explained to the class that Jordan was high-spirited and mischievous, but he was only following the immutable laws of genetics, since even a fool would know, Mrs. Sinus said this breathlessly, that it took a great deal of high spirits to break away from Mother England.
and both Capers and Jordan were related to 3 South Carolinians who signed the Declaration of Independence. She herself, she added with becoming modesty, was related only to 1 signer of the Declaration.
"Both Mr. Middleton and Mr. Elliot come from fine old distinguished South Carolina families. One might ask what difference it could possibly make, but experience teaches us it makes all the difference in the world. You can tell by the line of the jaw of both these young men that they descend from men and women who placed righteousness above mere glitter, justice above mere retribution, and elegance above the showy or the meretricious. You know what you're getting when you do business with a Middleton or an Elliot. Their character is set, their breeding impeccable. Have sons, Capers, have sons, Jordan. You must not allow these splendid South Carolina names to die out and be relegated into the boneyards of history. We will be studying the writings and exploits of your distinguished ancestors this year, and both of you will walk taller when you apprehend the value of the fine stock from which you issue. Every daughter you have will be a great name lost and cause for sorrow. Every son will be a name carrier."
Mike made gagging sounds behind Jordan and whispered, "Hey, name carrier, can I borrow some juicy fruit after I puke?" Jordan passed him a stick of juicy fruit, then shot Mike the finger. Mike said after class,
"One can tell from the line of my dick that I'm descended from one of the most distinguished bagel makers on the Upper West Side."
"Have sons, Mike, have sons," I cried out happily. "I'd rather watch a jockstrap mildew than listen to that woman's voice," Jordan said. But Mrs. Sanyas had found her champion in Capers, and he defended both her pedagogy and the content of her course to all comers.
"It's important to know where you've come from," Capers said.
"Why?" I asked. "What possible difference could it make? America's a democracy. Everyone gets a fair shake."
"Nonsense," Jordan said. "Half this town's black. Tell me the color of your skin doesn't make a difference in this stupid part of the country."
"Their time will come," Capers predicted. "They haven't earned it yet."
"You sound like such an idiot, Capers," Jordan said. "You're talking like you're 100 years old and you're only in the 9th grade. You believe everything your parents believe."
"I have more respect for my parents than any 2 people on earth," Capers said. "I owe everything to them."
"You're the unhippest, uncoolest kid I've ever met, man," Jordan said, appraising his cousin with a clear, unstinting California eye. "You're lucky you were born so deep in the sticks. Your show would close in a week out on the West Coast."
"You're calling me a square, aren't you?" Capers demanded.
"It's far worse than that," said Jordan. "You're square root, man. You're the kind of guy that likes to wear socks at the beach."
"Maybe I'm just proud of who I am."
"Maybe you're just a southern asshole," Jordan shot back.
"Have sons, Capers, have sons, Jordan," I said, trying to cut the tension between them.
Mike said, "This course'll help me when I write my memoirs, Jew Boy in the Confederacy. Do you think Mrs. Sanyas ever heard of Ellis Island? It's just a hop, skip, and a jump down from Plymouth Rock."
"South Carolina history," Jordan said, shaking his head. "What a contradiction in terms. I've lived all over the world, and I've never heard one person ever mention this state's name. It's nowhere, man. A loser state, if ever there was one. Nothing's ever happened here."
"The state of South Carolina seceded from the Union first," Capers bristled. "We fired on Fort Sumter and were the first to answer the call to arms."
"Then the North came down and kicked your Confederate asses from Richmond to Vicksburg."
"We gave as good as we got. Our generalship was superb," said Capers, moving toward a relaxed Jordan with clenched fists.
"One never reads about Lee's march on New York, but one does come across Sherman's march to the sea. I've studied Civil War battlefields with my father, Capers. I know a lot more about this subject than you do."
"You're not a true Southerner," Capers announced. "I'm an American, pal, and proud of it."
"Your family arrived in the New World in 1709. Mine came here in 1706. What went wrong with you?" Capers asked.
"When did your family get here, Jack?" Mike asked facetiously.
1908, something like that," I said, laughing, and Capers thought the laughter was directed at him.
"How about your family, Mike?"
"Very early, my family," Mike said. "They arrived on these virgin shores the same year the Edsel was introduced in Detroit."
"Have sons, have sons," Mike and I sang together, laughing in each other's arms.
For another class, Delia Sanyas read a chapter from William Eliot's 1859 book, Carolina Sports by Land and Water. Her reading voice was as monotonous as the sound of a running toilet. Half the class was asleep, and the other half daydreaming, while Delia labored to bring life to the serviceable prose of Jordan's great-grandfather and Capers's great-great-uncle on his mother's side. Delia read the first chapter, the showcase feature of the book, that had once dazzled Yankee fishermen, in which the Honorable Mr. Eliot describes the pursuit of the great manta ray, or devilfish, through the waters of Waterford Sound. Only Delia Sanyas, with her genius for monotony, could have rendered the hunt for the two-ton manta ray, with its great black-backed wings and bat-shaped body, to a colorless tale whose words settled over her class like a sleeping powder. She could make the charge of the light brigade sound like the directions for folding a napkin in a debutante's handbook. When Mr. Eliot placed a harpoon near the spine of a devilfish, and the enormous creature towed his slave-powered boat through the choppy waters off Hilton Head, the soft snoring of cheerleaders and football players intermingled, and I felt the sweat soak through the back of my shirt. Great heat and mediocre teaching have done much to lower the collective IQ of the South over the centuries. But one of her students listened to her with breathless attention and drank in every word she uttered. For Capers Middleton, what Delia Sanyas offered up from the dusty granary of her knowledge played a central part in his image of himself and his world. He not only felt a close, personal connection to South Carolina history, he thought of his own life as an enhancement and extension of it. From the day of his birth, he had enjoyed a highly developed sense of entitlement and privilege that had accrued to him through the accomplishments of his ancestors. That Christmas, Capers received from his parents a first-edition copy of Carolina Sports by Land and Water. The book thrilled Capers with its spirited accounts of fishing and hunting expeditions that had taken place in a less populated pre-Civil War Lowcountry. The land Eliot described was a green paradise teeming with game and fish. Capers made a spiritual connection with William Eliot and hunted the same animals his ancestor had hunted, and fished for the same fish at the exact same locations, so lovingly described by this energetic forebear. Capers' father commissioned a black metal worker from Charleston, who was expert in the repair of wrought iron fences, to fashion a harpoon for Capers exactly like the one wielded by William Eliot when he took to the channel and sounds in search of the great manta rays. Capers held this weapon and imagined the wild, dangerous rides that ensued after one of the enormous beasts was harpooned and turned in agony toward the high seas. He called upon the spirits of his ancestors when he tracked bobcat or white-tailed deer through the vast acreage of old rice plantations. He designed a secret task for himself. He wanted to kill every fish and animal that William Eliot had named in his book. In 1964, Jordan's father, now a full colonel, would be sent to a top-secret assignment overseas in a country called Vietnam. At that time, none of us had ever heard of Vietnam. Celeste and Eliot took a home on the Point, 3 blocks away from my house, and a block away from both Capers and Mike. That summer, we were inseparable. It was also the summer that Mike, Jordan, and I wished we had paid more attention to Delia Sanyas' South Carolina history course. In April, on every Sunday, Capers had been borrowing his father's 18-foot Rankin fishing boat and taken to the river for an all-day fishing trip. All of us were competitive fishermen who took great pride in our gear and tackle. We changed baits and lures frequently as conditions changed and teased each other relentlessly as we went from oyster bank to deep drop in our pursuit of game fish. We baited our hooks with iced-down eels, then cast them in front of great swimming forms of cobia hunting along the surface. The cobia were torpedo-shaped and powerful, and they were my favorite fish to cook and eat at a campfire. Capers's harpoon had proved a symbolic but useless gift. During a flounder-gigging trip on a moonless night, he had tried to use the harpoon to gig the flounder exposed in the soft mud flats and sandbars by the light of a lantern on a John boat. We would let the boat drift over shallow water and take turns gigging flounder that had buried themselves in sand
to await prey passing overhead. The flounder's silhouette was as distinctive as a pretty woman's profile in a cameo. A three-pronged gig brought the flounder into the boat cleanly. Capers's harpoon was so large that the fish was mutilated and its flesh ruined by the blow. Once Capers used the harpoon to land a 50-pound sand shark, but even then it proved too much weapon for not enough fish. And so it lay unused that summer in the gunwale of the boat, tied to 100 feet of thick marine rope. From time to time Capers would justify its remaining there by reminding Jordan that the descendants of William Elliot never went to sea unprepared for an emergency. But there were too many fish to catch with regular tackle, and we even landed a cobia weighing over 40 pounds. I cooked those cobia steaks over a campfire with corn oil, butter, and lemon juice, and that became the first recipe I ever sold to a newspaper. In the first week of August, Mike hit a triple off the wall at College Park in Charleston, driving in 3 runs and winning the lower state championship for the Waterford American Legion team. Capers had been on 3rd, I was on 2nd, and Jordan on 1st, when Mike teed off on the first pitch by the Conway relief pitcher. The 4 of us were growing strong together, coming into our season as athletes at the same time. When Jordan pitched, nothing was safe if the ball went to the outfield, where Mike played a swift left field, and Capers covered an amazing amount of ground in center, and no one dared test my now legendary throwing arm in right. Jordan knew we played a cunning outfield. Little got by us, nothing through us, and we always hit the cutoff man. After the baseball season was over, we moved into my family's fishing camp on the southwest side of the Isle of Orion for the rest of the summer. During the first week, we loaded the Middleton's 18-foot Rankin with extra tanks of gas, chose a day of superb calm and a weather report that called for nothing but clear skies, then struck out with our 75-horsepower motor for the Gulf Stream. The older fishermen spoke of the Gulf Stream in reverential tones as a great secret indigo river born in the south, bringing a warm current and the traffic of marlin and whales toward the North Star and England. Out there the waters were silver or cobalt blue, and the fish weighed as much as automobiles. All fishermen who returned from the Gulf Stream told stories of wonder and exhaustion, about the strength of the great fish coaxed up from the depths. It took us an hour to get to the open sea, and we had told no one of our plans, because no adult would have allowed such a long trip in such a small boat. Before sunrise, we had passed the last buoy marking the channel opening. The sea was lake-like as the first light hit it, and the bow of our boat was pointed in the direction of Africa. We felt as adventurous as though our destination actually was Cameroon or the Ivory Coast. In a cooler, we had packed enough food and drink to last for 2 days. We were averaging 20 knots as we got farther and farther away from the sight of land. "My mama would kill my Jewish ass if she knew where I was right this minute," Mike said as he scanned the horizon and saw only an endless circle of water. "She thinks that I'm crabbing for my dinner with chicken necks as we speak."
"We should have brought a radio," Jordan said.
"Low country boys don't need no radios," Capers said, keeping his eye on the compass and the boat pointed due east. "We were born in the pluff mud with gills and flippers. Man, I was born to go out to the Gulf Stream."
"We don't need radios, California boy," I teased, "because we've got gonads big as Goodyear blimps."
"You've got brains the size of houseflies," said Jordan, surveying the ocean around him. "Lucky this is such a pussy ocean. You wouldn't stick your big toe in the Pacific without a radio."
"They didn't have any radios on the Mayflower," Capers said. "Columbus couldn't call back to chat with Ferdinand. Nothing to fear. The master mariner's here."
"Nobody knows we're out here," Jordan said.
"The guy at the marina knows we're going on a trip," I said. "We filled up 6 tankfuls of fuel."
"We couldn't go if we told our parents," Capers said.
"My folks would have a cow if they knew I was out here," I said.
Capers called over the sound of the engine.
"It might drive your father to drink."
I ignored the remark and looked back at where land was supposed to be.
"I could never be wild enough for my father," Jordan said. "I could drive up to Spartanburg, impregnate every girl at Converse College, and my father would still think I was a faggot."
Before we reached the Gulf Stream, we arrived at a vast acreage of sargassum, the grasslands of the North Atlantic,
that formed a drifting archipelago of brown seaweed, which was more chlorophyll-rich than Kansas. It was the first sign that we were nearing the Gulf Stream itself. In Earth Science class, our teacher, Walter Nann, had drawn a chart of the Gulf Stream as it flowed out of the Gulf of Mexico and went up the coast of Florida. Mr. Nann was one of those introspective scientists who believed that nature simply proved the amplitude and mathematical genius of God. With the Gulf Stream, Mr. Nann could talk about weather patterns, the movement of fish and plant life from the Caribbean to the coast of South Carolina, and the natural application of the Coriolis force, the curved angles of lines drawn straight across a spinning surface. The Earth spun on its axis, the Moon pulled the waters with its puppeteer hands, and the Gulf Stream moved like a secret warm water Nile through the heart of the Atlantic, keeping England from being a snowbound kingdom. The Gulf Stream brought good news from the south to the cold, inhospitable countries of Europe, a love letter sent out of southern waters to melt icebergs in the shipping lanes near Greenland. The water changed when we entered the Gulf Stream itself, becoming a jewel-like blue that looked as if it flowed out of the heart of some stone not native to our region. The water was clean-looking and moving swiftly as a mountain river. As Lowcountry boys, we found clear water to be deeply disturbing. As soon as the Rankin entered the stream itself, the color of the water went from dark to light blue. Once Capers looked down to see we were floating in 200 feet of water. Glancing down at the depth finder a few minutes later, Capers was stunned to find the ocean's depth had plummeted to 1,000 feet. He reported this fact to the rest of us, and we whistled in disbelief. "You can drown in 3 feet of water as easy as 1,000, said Jordan, trying to relieve the sense of awe that had seized everyone on the boat. All of us hovered around the depth finder, thumping it with our fingers to see if it were given a false reading. Mike said, "Yeah, but they've got a better chance of finding you in 3 feet of water. What kind of fish grows in water that deep?" "Big mothers," Capers said. "Anything that wants to," Jordan added. "You've got to be able to kick some ass when you hit your ride north on the Gulf Stream." "We might see some whales," I said. Jordan said, "We should have brought a radio." Capers laughed and said, "Radios are for pussies. Let's bait up." I took over the wheel and turned the bow of the boat northward, adjusting it to trolling speed after taking the flow of the current into account. I loved the business of fishing, the beauty and efficiency of the tackle, the tying of elegant knots, the testing of the line, and the selection of the proper bait for the right conditions. It pleased me to watch my friends as they studied the contents of their well-organized tackle boxes before they made their choices for the moment they would cast their lines into these fabled waters. A half moon rested in the western sky, a pale watermark left by the night before. I thought I saw birds skimming low across the water, and then realized I was seeing my first flying fish. Their faces were dog-like, earnest, and they had the wings of bad angels. Though I knew nothing of their habits, I guessed these fish flew because they were being pursued by something huge and deadly beneath them. "Hell, let's get some bait fish," Mike said. "I'm not sure these artificial lures will attract the big fish out here worth a damn." "Good idea," I said, and turned the boat back toward shore, going a couple of miles before we found a spot near a great expanse of sargassum that looked promising. We anchored the boat, then dropped our lines deep, baited with cut mullet and shrimp. Floating in that perfectly still ocean, it was as though we were trapped in the reflection of the Earth's image of itself. The gardens of sargassum were alive with fish, and we used our smaller rods with 20-pound test lines. Within 20 minutes, Capers had put a hook through a small dolphin fish, while Mike and Jordan caught the more pedestrian mullet. In low voices, we talked about the depth each one of us would fish once we returned to deep waters. It was agreed that Capers would fish the deepest, and that Jordan and Mike would troll from the side of the boat, one at 50 feet, the other at the surface. We checked the gaff, the resiliency of our bigger rods, and discussed protocol if someone tied into a fish. I gave them the word when we entered the Gulf Stream once again, and began calling out the depth as we entered deeper and deeper water. "You've got too much line there," Mike said to Capers, who always came with more expensive equipment than the rest of us. His Plano tackle box overflowed with hooks and lures he had never used, but Capers was a flamboyant, competitive fisherman. He measured success by size and number. Since he was on his first trip to the Gulf Stream, he wanted to come back with a game fish, and nothing less would do.
50-pound test line, Capers announced proudly.
You could pull up an alligator with that, I yelled back to him.
I'm putting my peanut dolphin down deep.
What are we fishing for? Mike asked. I don't even know what I'm supposed to catch.
We're trading up, said Jordan.
Trophies, Capers said. Things to put on our walls.
For a half hour I cruised along, mesmerized by the circle of water around me and the circle of sky above that seemed made of one color and one substance. Only the sound of the boat seemed incongruent and unwelcome. I felt the wordless ingathering of harmony that comes when you strike out alone and enter into the cathedral-like silence of nature, far removed from cities. For a brief moment, the noise of the motor had disappeared, expunged by the vastness and silkiness of an Atlantic that was initiating us to its depths with a perfect stillness. My three friends disappeared from my consciousness, as I was sure I had disappeared from theirs. Then something took the dolphin, something large, something running far below. Jordan and Mike reeled in their lines, I cut the motor, and the three of us took up positions to watch Capers test his inland water skills as a fisherman of the Gulf Stream. Though Capers was always accused of using too much rod, he was not using too much rod for this fish. The fish had taken the hook and almost took the rod away from him as it made its first run, but Capers played it beautifully. The line sang off his reel, and Capers let it go, enjoying the fact that he was on stage, performing for his friends. We all watched the line playing out at an alarming rate as Capers began applying the slightest, most delicate bit of drag.
"What does it feel like?" Mike asked.
"Like I've hooked a locomotive," Capers answered.
He played the fish well, but it was a fish of great strength and heart and fighting spirit.
"I want to see this fish," Jordan said, after 15 minutes of the contest had passed by without bringing it near the surface. By now, the sweat glistened on Capers's face and chest, and on the hairs on his legs.
"You'll have plenty of time to see it," Capers said. "I'm going to catch the son of a bitch."
"It might be too big to bring into the boat," I said. "Who knows what it is? It could be a mako or a great white."
"You forgot about my harpoon," Capers said. His voice strained as he fought the fish standing straight up. "Get it ready."
I pulled the harpoon out from under the bow of the boat and lifted the leather protective cover from the blade. Taking a whetstone from Capers' tackle box, I sharpened its edges until I saw a wicked smile of new silver running the length of the blade. I touched the blade and drew a line of blood on my thumb. Mike brought out a rope and tied one end to the harpoon and the other to a stanchion in the boat. Then we saw the fish. All of us had caught large fish during our careers on the water, but none of us were prepared for the size of the blue marlin that came leaping out of the water 50 yards behind the boat. I felt a sudden rush of joy and clarity as the marlin, in the full extension of its soaring leap into sunshine, took us into new realms. It was our first encounter with fish as myth, as nightmare, as beast. We whooped in amazement, but Capers was too exhausted to make any noise at all. He felt a surge of adrenaline course through his body, easing the terrible aching of the muscles in his back, shoulders, and arms. His whole body fought the fish with all the cunning of a low country boy who had spent a lifetime landing spot-tail bass, king mackerel, and migrating blues. But I doubt whether all the fish Capers had ever caught would equal the astonishing weight of this one fierce and acrobatic marlin. It leapt again and danced across the still water on its great forked tail, agile as a ballerina, then fell into the sea like a small plane crashing near our boat. We all whistled in awe.
"We can't bring him on the boat," I said.
"Bullshit!"
Capers cried out, in a voice that did not sound like his own.
"It's bigger than the boat," I explained.
"We'll kill it with the harpoon," Mike said.
"Jack's right," Jordan said. "It could sink us."
"We'll tie it to the boat," Capers whispered.
"I've already read that book, man," Mike said. "That's old man in the sea shit. We'll be fighting off sharks all night."
"We've got a motor," I said. "We could make it back okay, I guess."
"Capers ain't caught it yet," said Jordan. "That fish isn't looking tired. It's just warming up." "Want one of us to take over, pal?" Mike asked.
"It's my fish," Capers said. "I'm bringing it in by myself."
"That's the spirit that made our country great," I said sarcastically.
"You look like you're dying," Jordan said. Mike was just trying to help.
"This could be a record," Capers gasped. "It won't count if anyone helps me land the fish."
"We'll lie," I suggested. "We'll all swear on a stack of Bibles that you brought it in yourself."
"I believe in rules," Capers said, his shirt drenched in sweat. "Rules are a form of discipline. They have their own reason for existing."
The three of us broke out in mock applause for Capers' speech.
"Laugh now, losers," Capers said, "but you'll read my name in Sports Illustrated after they weigh this baby back at the marina."
"Because you were so nasty about it," Mike said, "I'm going to claim I helped reel in this fish."
"Me too."
"Same here," I agreed.
"You can all kiss my ass," Capers said. "My word's good in Waterford. I've got 300 years of Middleton honesty backing me up."
Then the marlin made another long, deep run, and the line sang off the reel again. It suddenly went slack, and Capers began reeling in madly, his right hand moving in a blur as the fish shot up out of the depths for what would be another spectacular leap into the air. I could see the pain lining Capers' face and how he had lost his concentration because of it. The muscles in his hands and fingers were cramping, and Capers shook one hand into the air, trying to get the circulation flowing again, to put out the fiery spasms that were spreading along the nerves and muscles leading up his arm. As he once more frantically reeled in the line, the marlin reversed its course and dove with all its mighty strength toward the bottom of the sea. When the line broke, the four of us groaned in one voice.
"Son of a bitch! Son of a bitch!" Capers cried out feebly as he reeled in the weightless line.
His voice was despairing, and he screamed out at the calm ocean, then hurled his rod and reel as far as he could throw it into the sea. It landed with a splash that seemed meaningless after the marlin's spectacular re-entry into the water. Watching Capers's bereft expression, I waited breathlessly for him to break down and weep in sheer frustration, but instead he dove straight down off the stern of the boat into the water. He was underwater for a full 20 seconds before he emerged, took a breath, then plunged downward toward the bottom again. When he returned to the surface, Jordan said,
"I don't think you can catch him that way, Capers. He's probably halfway to Africa by now."
"I'll never hook another fish like that again in my life," Capers said as he treaded water. "A man only gets one chance in his life to catch a fish that big."
"What fish?" Mike said. "I didn't see a fish."
"You sorry son of a bitch," Capers said.
"Why don't you get in the boat?" I asked.
Capers shook his head and said,
"I can't lift my arms."
"No wonder that fish got away," Mike said, extending a hand to Capers in the water. But Capers was too tired to even reach up to Mike, who leaned way down to the water and grabbed him under the armpits and motioned for me to help. As Capers moaned in pain, we lifted him out of the Atlantic. Capers slumped into a seat, spent, worn out, limp.
"All my life I've gotten everything I've wanted," he said. "Everything. Great parents, perfect grades. I'm the one who gets the hit in the 9th inning, scores the winning touchdown, takes the last shot. The prettiest girls write me notes in school. I've been elected class president every year since the 3rd grade. Now this. Lost. Defeated. Fucked. I never wanted anything more than I did to catch that fish."
"Maybe the fish didn't know who you were," Jordan offered. "Hell, if that fish knew about the grades and the pretty girls, he'd have just jumped on into this boat."
"That was the biggest fish I ever saw," I said. "How much do you think it weighed? I bet 1,000 pounds.
"Nah," Mike said. "More like 100.
"Not an ounce more than 50, Jordan said. "Fish look bigger out here in the Gulf Stream."
"Sons of bitches," Capers said, his eyes closed. "The only thing I need in life is a better set of friends."
For another half hour we trolled the Gulf Stream before we began to worry about the amount of fuel we were consuming and the small chance we had of making another strike. We decided to head back toward shore, stopping to bottom fish near some of the heavier concentrations of sargassum. Where there was seaweed, there was bound to be a profusion of sea life. When we came to a drop near what appeared to be a canyon wall of sargassum,
Jordan threw out the anchor into the seaweed itself, and its flanges hooked into the dense undersea jungle. While the rest of us changed tackle and baited hooks, Capers crawled up under the gunwale, away from the heat of the sun, and instantly fell asleep. His disappointment was still so bitter and recent that we thought it wiser to let Capers sleep off the marlin's fabulous memory than to coax him into fishing for red snapper. We took turns rubbing each other's shoulders and backs with a combination of baby oil and mercurochrome. Stripping down to our bathing suits, we glistened with sweat and oil as we let our lines out and fished the bottom with cut bait. Before we broke for lunch, we had caught a string of 15 grouper, the largest of which we estimated was 20 pounds. For lunch, we opened bags of potato chips, peanut M&Ms, Hostess cupcakes, and cans of Vienna sausages. We snapped off the tops of Coca-Colas and root beers and talked quietly so as not to disturb the deep sleep of Capers, who had not moved a single muscle of his body. Our lunch was an infallible combination of the worst foods produced in America, and it all tasted great. Jordan talked about trolling an artificial lure on the trip home that he heard had drawn the spirited attention of King Mackerel near an artificial reef off the coast of Charleston. We spoke dreamily about fish, sports, girls, yet later could not remember a single specific of that conversation. Taking our time, we gathered up all the trash and put it into a single bag. Capers was still sleeping too soundly to wake. I was sharpening my hook, and Jordan was getting ready to cast, when Mike said, "Let's fish here for just an hour, then head back to shore. We'll make sure we've got plenty of daylight when we head back." "We've got plenty of time," I said, now tying the hook onto my lure. "We're on a sandbar," Jordan said, looking down at his line. "No way, Jose," Mike said. "This is the middle of the Atlantic. Sandbars won't be a problem till we get back to the Sound." I cast my line out near Jordan's and instantly saw that something was wrong. My bait had landed on a sandy bottom. "I can see my bait," I said. "I can see my bait on the bottom, too," Jordan said. "We're over 60 feet at least," Mike said, checking the depth meter.
"Then how come we're both looking at our bait?" Jordan asked.
"We're in 3 feet of water, Mike," I said.
"I still read 60 feet.
"Read what you want," Jordan said. "Come look."
Mike walked to the back of the boat, shaking his head and swaggering as he pulled the bill of his baseball cap low over his forehead. He adjusted his sunglasses, then lifted them off so he could see into the water with less distortion.
"I see your baits," he said. "They are on the bottom."
Then Jordan and I both heard Mike's voice freeze, and we could feel his fear spreading like a fatal toxin in the air between us.
"Jesus Christ! Reel your lines in slow, boys, so slow that it can't feel a thing. Don't move, don't breathe, don't do shit, but slowly get your hooks away from that big son of a bitch."
"What is it?" Jordan whispered.
"The marlin?"
"I don't know what the hell it is, but it could eat that marlin. My God, it just keeps on going. I've never seen anything so big in my whole life. Never." We reeled our lines in slowly, with imperceptible movements of the wrists, and the light off the water made the water diamond-backed and opaque. Whatever Mike saw, we could not yet see. When we set our rods down, we sank to our knees beside Mike and peered into the depths. Yet again, it looked as though we had drifted above a sandbar composed of the blackest parts of the sea and the earth. The black bottom we were over was alien and strange, but I still could not see what had alarmed Mike so much. Then Jordan spotted it and gasped in amazement.
"My God in heaven," he said. "Don't move a muscle, Jack. I see it, Mike, I see it. It's huge."
"I don't see nothing at all," I said, frustrated that I was looking at the exact same area that Jordan was. It was like looking at one of those children's puzzles with the animals hidden in the foliated shapes of the forests. And then my eyes adjusted to what I was actually seeing. Slowly, it became clear that what I thought was land was alive. Not only was it alive, I was staring at the largest sea creature I'd ever seen. It wasn't swimming, it was hovering, the way ospreys and kingfishers hover over lagoons before diving down for mullet. To my left, I saw the delicate movement of a wing that must have weighed a ton. To my right, I saw a black fin break the surface of the water, then slide back beneath the water's barely ruffled surface.
"I've seen one of these things before," I said. "It's a manta ray, a devilfish, the biggest one in the world. They're harmless, just don't move a muscle. Call Delia Sinus."
When I was 8 years old, I'd been taken out to fish the wreck of the Brunswick Moon, which had sunk off the Isle of Orion during the hurricane of 1893. My father and grandfather had brought me as a rite of passage. I was being initiated in the habits and folkways of men. My grandfather Silas taught me how to find the wreck by placing our boat in the center of six palmettos that sat to the right of a bent live oak on shore. I remembered that day not so much for the fish we had caught, but for the stories I heard the two men tell, and the feeling that adulthood was a club and an entitlement. While we were coming back from that fishing trip, we encountered a school of manta rays playing in the channel that led to the small port in Waterford. Whether the manta rays were engaged in a mating ritual or frolicked for the sheer joy of play was never clear, but I knew that my father and grandfather felt as awed by this gathering of giants that day as I was. The rays frolicked with such enthusiasm that they made the water around them seem storm-tossed. It was like watching dark fields suddenly spring to life, new acreage at play. The shape of the mantas was bestial, demon-winged, and massive. The school could have been mistaken for a feeding frenzy among tiger sharks lost in a maze of chum and blood. But what I remembered was how frisky they were, like spaniels with each other, capable of great horseplay and affection. They leapt out of the water and played tag, like overactive children released from a strict daycare center. The ocean was turbulent with their size and exuberance, and for an hour we had followed the manta rays as they performed their great and inexplicable dance along the coastal waters of South Carolina. Though huge, none of the mantas that day approached the immensity of the creature that hovered like a black, bird-like chimera 3 feet below us. It could have been asleep, it could have been watching us out of curiosity. The manta ray's mouth looked large enough to swallow our 18-foot Rankin whole. The boat that had always seemed solid and seaworthy to me now seemed as fragile as a balsa raft. "I'm going to try to hook this baby," I said, recovering my composure. "I hear they love shrimp." I reached for my pole, but Jordan grabbed my wrist hard and held it. "I was joking," I said. "Do you think I'm an idiot?"
"You don't joke about something that big," Jordan said.
Then we heard Mike scream and turned around just in time to see Capers Middleton, the great-great-nephew of William Elliot, raising his harpoon into the sunlight and throwing it powerfully toward the spine of the great manta ray. Neither Jordan nor I had time to utter a single word of alarm or caution. We saw the blade of the harpoon slashing through the air. Then we were pitched forward as the manta ray came hurtling out of the water and over our boat. Looking up after my head hit the boat's railing, I saw the creature's white underbelly pass over the boat like some biblical angel of death after the expulsion from paradise. A terrible breaking of metal interlocked with our terrified screams as the harpoon rope tangled with the motor and tore it off as though it were made of wax. We almost capsized as the rope swept along the length of the boat, and if any of us had been standing, it would have decapitated us in an instant. It tore the windshield off as though it were made of bread. The next thing we knew, the boat was being dragged through the water at a speed that seemed enormous. For several minutes, Jordan and I lay shaken next to each other, disoriented among the debris in the bottom of the boat. My left eyebrow was cut open, and blood was streaming down my face. A hook had pierced Jordan's cheek, and, in agony, he was trying to work it out. Mike and Capers lay still, and blood was pooling beneath Capers' head. The sun was still high, and I estimated that it must be nearing 3 o'clock in the afternoon. I could not believe how fast we were hurtling through the ocean without a motor. Before I rose, I tried to figure in my mind how large the fish was that passed over us in the agony of its first leap. Its shadow had cut the sun like an eclipse, and its shape was unearthly. I moved toward Mike and realized he was seriously hurt. A piece of broken bone was sticking out of an ugly wound on his forearm.
"Mike, you... Oh, God!" I cried out.
Then I heard a strangled sound and saw Jordan pointing to his mouth and the hook.
I struggled toward Jordan and worked the hook until I saw it come out of the bloody soft tissue near Jordan's lower molars. Taking the hook, I pulled it out the front of his mouth. Then, reaching into my own tackle box, I took out a first aid kit and rubbed the wounded cheek down with raw alcohol, and again heard Jordan scream out in pain. "We're in deep shit," I said. "Help me throw Capers overboard," Jordan said, holding his cheek. "We're in this pickle because he's a dumbass." "He didn't know," I said, trying to clean Jordan's face and keep my eyes away from Mike's broken arm. "That thing could have killed all of us." "Give it time," I said. "Why did he throw that harpoon?"
"Because he lost the marlin," I guessed.
Jordan shook his head and said, "No, I bet he thought he was being true to the aristocratic spirit of our Elliot ancestors. Those family ties have screwed our boy up. He'd rather kill a Yankee at Antietam, but spearing a devilfish is the next best thing. He might have just killed all four of us."
"Well, they'll come looking for us," I said, trying to be reassuring. "Waterford's got a great Marine rescue squad."
"They don't know where in the hell to look," Jordan said. "They think we're crabbing in one of the creeks, reading back issues of Playboy magazine. It's going to be a leap for them to know we're being towed out to sea by a 2-ton manta ray."
We then placed life preservers beneath Mike's and Capers' heads. Both were still unconscious. We climbed to the bow of the boat and studied the taut rope that disappeared into the sea 30 yards in front of us. The harpoon must have driven itself deep into that black-muscled wing, and it occurred to me that the beast was simply fleeing like any grazing animal, surprised by hunters and enduring unimaginable pain. The manta ray was trying to escape from our boat. That much was clear as the wind blew through our hair and the sun bore down on our faces and wounds, which stung every time the bow broke through a wave of a now rising sea. Later, we would talk about the things we should have done in those first minutes, but both Jordan and I were still in shock at the violence and suddenness of what had overtaken our fishing trip. We took no pleasure in the joyride by the great fish, but simply rode it out passively in a zen-like state, subsumed by the awesome power of the unseen and the ineffable. One moment of sheer recklessness had placed us in great peril, and we watched, witnesses to our own executions, as our fate played itself out in the water beneath us. But we could also feel the terror and the panic of the immense manta as it tore through the ocean with the blade driven into its flanks. We thought that we might soon die, and though we sat shoulder to shoulder on the boat, I felt as though I were taking the ruined, wild ride alone. We offered each other no sense of companionship or fraternity. For 20 miles, the manta ray dragged the boat through surf that grew increasingly rough. As a wind arose from the east, the animal began to slow down, no doubt from exhaustion and loss of blood. I wondered if we would be dragged down to the bottom of the sea when the giant manta died, and it was only then I said, "Should we untie the rope?" to no one in particular. "We'll have to cut it loose from that front cleat," Jordan said, still holding his hand over his cheek. Then, suddenly, the rope slackened in the water, and I thought that the manta ray had managed to free itself from the harpoon. But within seconds, the manta came roaring out of the water in its full, monstrous glory, like some forgotten behemoth from the mythology of a lost continent. It was winged and titanic as it took to the air and flapped its wings like some fierce, prehistoric bird. Its leap took us by surprise, and we nearly fell off the side of the boat when it hit the water with a thunderous clap that could have been heard from miles. Frightened, we eased down into the seats of the boat and held on tightly as the manta ray executed a series of leaps. It rose out of the water again and again, like some new species of death and darkness that fear had fashioned for its leisure. Then the manta ray reversed its course and began coming toward the boat. Mike screamed in pain as he awoke, but we were so transfixed, watching the rope go slack again, suspended in an agony of anticipation as we awaited the sounding of the great fish, that we did not respond. Mike was still screaming when the manta ray left the water, coming out toward and over us, the white belly passing over and blocking the sun once more, eradicating all hope of our deliverance and eventual safety. The boat seemed puny in the shadow of the wounded beast, and if the manta ray had landed on top of it, it would have crushed all four of us
as easily as if we had been the larvae of eels. But the manna twisted away, somersaulted in mid-air, and loosed itself from the harpoon, snapping the rope at the same instant. Its left wing smashed down on the starboard side of the boat, and as the craft dipped into the sea, we took in water before it suddenly righted itself. Jordan and I began bailing with the Dixie cups that lay scattered all over the boat. Bailing with two hands and cups, it seemed forever before the boat was mostly clear of water. Only then could we turn to Mike, whose moaning was dreadful to hear. Jordan set Mike's broken arm as best he could, wrapping it tightly with rags torn from a T-shirt and waterproof tape from one of the tackle boxes. He checked on Capers and washed out the deep wound at the back of his head, guessing out loud that Capers had a concussion. He even offered to sew up the ugly gash that ran across my eyebrow, but I demurred. We drifted that night, heavy with sun and exhaustion, into a dreamless sleep that resembled unconsciousness. It felt as deep as the sea itself. I was already up when Capers awoke and the first light seeped out of the eastern horizon. Though still dazed and unsteady, he took in the sleeping figures around him, touched his head wound several times, and surveyed the condition of the boat.
"What in the hell did you boys do to my father's boat?" he said in a loud voice.
"Go back to sleep, Capers," I said.
"What did you do to the motor?" Capers said. "Oh, my God, my father's going to kill you guys when he sees what you've done."
"You don't remember?" I asked.
"Remember what? The manta ray?"
"You mean the marlin?" he said.
"I hooked a marlin that got away. Then I went to sleep, and I woke up, and you guys have ruined my daddy's boat."
"Save your strength, Ahab," Jordan said, sitting up and looking out at the ocean spread out around us.
"You guys are going to have to help me pay for the damage," Capers said, his voice growing more shrill. "The motor alone cost over $2,000.
Jordan went over to Mike and checked his arm. Mike, too, was awake, but his broken arm hurt too much for him to either speak or move. His eyes looked unnaturally bright, and Jordan put his hand to his forehead and felt the fever.
"I demand to know what happened," Capers said. "I'm the captain of the vessel, and I'll be goddamned if we're going to go another inch without someone telling me what went wrong. How do you expect us to go anywhere without a motor?"
Capers asked no one in particular. "Jack and I took a vote while you were asleep," Jordan said. "We thought it'd be fun to float back to Waterford." I laughed, then explained to Capers and Mike what had transpired after Capers had thrown the harpoon at the manta ray. Mike remembered seeing Capers lifting the harpoon, but Capers never regained a single memory of the incident. He sat and listened to the story with utter astonishment.
"You shouldn't have let me do that," Capers said, touching the sore place on the back of his head. "One of you should have stopped me."
"It was our fault, okay," Mike said. "Good thinking, Capers."
"Help me think of something to tell Dad," Capers said. "A whale. We got caught in a school of humpback whales, and one of their tails knocked the engine loose. I'll work out some of the specifics."
"You'll have plenty of time," I said, looking out where land was supposed to be. Mike struggled to stand up, but the pain almost brought him to his knees. Jordan sat him down and tried to make him comfortable, propping up his arm with seat cushions and life preservers. "Later on, I want to get you into the water, Mike. Let's make sure that wound is good and clean."
"No way! I'm not getting in no water that got shit in it as big as that manta ray."
"I wish I could have seen it," Capers said. Jordan answered, "You saw it well enough to get us here."
"We're lost at sea," Capers said.
"Thanks for that bulletin," Jordan said.
Mike laughed and said, "No, baby, we're just fucked. As fucked as any four humans have a right to be."
"I'll get us out of this," Capers said. "I'll think of something." Capers stepped up and stood looking out toward the endless expanse of water. Putting his hands on his hips, he struck a pose of deeply aggrieved authority. For a full 5 minutes, he stood there, until Mike said, "You think of anything yet?" Capers' voice was grave, subdued, as he said, "Do you know we have a good chance of dying out here?"
"He's a thinker," Mike said, nodding. "He's got all the angles covered."
"Thanks for shedding more light on the subject," I said. "We're not going to die," Jordan announced.
"What's going to stop us?" Mike asked.
"My father," Jordan said. "My asshole father."
"He's not here," Capers said. When I was a little boy, my old man would take me out on maneuvers with him on weekends. He told my mother we were going camping. He'd take me deep into the woods of Camp Lejeune or Quantico, force march me 15 or 20 miles, then make me pretend we were at war. We lived off the land. We ate mushrooms and crawdads and wild asparagus. I ate frog legs and flower petals and insects. Do you know that an insect is almost pure protein? "I hope you never open a restaurant, man," Mike said. But Jordan continued, "I hated those weekends with my father, and I was always afraid. He loved to test himself when there was nothing between him and nature. If one of America's enemies landed on these shores," he would tell me, "men like him would take to the forests for years. They would hunt the enemy only at night, using knives and sticks and razor blades. Once he killed a baby deer, and we ate it for 3 straight nights, all of it, liver, kidneys, heart." "Puke," said Mike.
"That won't help us out here," Capers said.
"Yes, it will. Just do whatever I tell you," said Jordan. "I know a lot about hunger and thirst. Before long, we're all going to know a lot about both of them. But for now, I can keep us all alive."
"Then do it," I said.
"But I'm the president of our class," Capers said. The three of us studied him, suddenly dumbfounded, but Capers explained himself by saying,
"What I mean is that I'm accustomed to leadership. Tell Jordan I've always been the class president. Tell him, Mike, Jack."
"We're not talking about who's going to set up tables for the sock hop," Mike said. "His father taught him survival skills, Capers," I explained. "He's going to use those same skills to keep us alive out here on the ocean."
"But there's nothing to eat or drink out here," Capers said.
"Our first enemy is right there," Jordan said, pointing out toward the east. "If we're in this boat long enough, the sun's going to kill us."
"Hey," said Capers, "Fort Lauderdale at Easter time. This'll give us a chance to work on our tans."
"No time for jokes, son," Mike said. "Mike laughs less when Mike might die."
"Get us out of this, Jordan," I said. "You want to play leader of the pack? Play leader of the pack."
"What do we do, Jordan?" Mike asked.
"You and Capers get under the gunwale, out of the sun. Take off all your clothes. Jack and I'll cover ourselves best we can. We've got a little bit of water left in this ice chest. We'll ration it out, but only at night. Jack and I'll spend all day fishing. Don't move around. Conserve energy."
"They'll find us sometime today," Capers said.
"Maybe, but we're going to act like they're never going to find us," Jordan said.
"You're just trying to scare us," Capers said.
"He's doing a damn good job, too," I said.
"Yeah, that's exactly what I'm trying to do."
Mike asked, "Why, Jordan? What's the use of scaring us half to death?"
"Because no one knows where we are," said Jordan. "No one knows where to begin to look. We don't have a radio, flares, or emergency equipment of any kind. We've got enough water to last us for 2 or 3 days. If it doesn't rain after that, then we'll die of thirst in 5 days. Maybe we'll last a week."
"What a pretty picture," I said.
"I'm going to be dead because Capers Middleton is an asshole," Mike said, shaking his head.
"There's no proof that I threw that harpoon," Capers said, as the three of us stared at him. "For all I know, the three of you might have plotted this tale while I was unconscious."
"Trust us, Capers," I said. "It wasn't no flounder or mermaid that dragged us out this far and tore our motor off."
"My dad is going to kill me when he sees what we did to this boat," said Capers.
"We, Paleface?" Mike asked. "I personally do not see where the first person plural has any part in this conversation. You didn't ask anyone's permission to spear that fish. You gave in to an impulse, Capers. It was definitely freelance."
"Look, we went fishing," Capers said. "I was just trying to catch a fish. No one can blame me for that."
"The fish was big as a building," I said. "You should have seen it." Our submission to Jordan's discipline was complete. We followed every order he issued without argument. For a boy accustomed to solitude, he adjusted himself well to a life of scheduling and forced companionship, and command came surprisingly easy to him. We floated through still, airless days, and on the second evening at sea, Jordan gave the order that each of us must jump into the ocean and wash ourselves and our clothing well. "Jack, you go in first. Capers and I'll lower Mike into the water. Mike, you've got to let the salt water clean out your wound. All of us need to soak our cuts and wounds. One man will always stay in the boat while the others are in the water. Keep near the boat, always in reach. I dropped over the side of the boat and entered an ocean that was cold and deep and frightening. The salt stung the wound that ran along my eyebrow, but I stifled a cry of pain and waited as Capers and Jordan carefully let Mike down without causing further injury to his arm. I took his weight and guided him gently into the water. None of us liked the way Mike looked. His complexion seemed ashy and waxen below his tan. But he made not a sound as his arm entered the water, and he allowed Jordan to massage and manipulate the tightly bound splint. He moaned softly every time Jordan touched his broken arm, but he submitted to the tender ministrations because Jordan maintained his air of authority, even while naked and dog-paddling in the Atlantic. "Don't drink any salt water," Jordan said, "no matter how thirsty you get. The salt dehydrates you. It takes 3 times more urine to wash the salt out of your system than normal."
"Who are you?" Capers said from the boat. "My doctor?"
At night, we talked and fished and dried our clothes in the cool, clean air. We moved around freely, each of us assigned to his own separate duties. With lures and one of the bait fish that had survived the encounter with the manta ray, we began to fish in earnest, knowing that what we caught was the only thing that would keep us alive. Jordan had checked the level of water in the ice chest and realized it would not last another day, and there had been no clouds in the sky for days. When the sun was high, Jordan made Mike and Capers get beneath the gunwale of the boat, tightly packed and uncomfortable, but away from the strongest rays of the sun. He and I would pull the boat's tarpaulin cover over ourselves. High noon was a time of complete hibernation and stillness on the boat, and we adapted our rhythms to a strict but altogether new cycle that was the exact opposite of our usual daily lives. We trained ourselves to be on the alert for any sounds of airplanes or boat engines that might be searching for us. Once we spotted a search plane flying to the north, and we rose, screaming and shouting, as the aircraft drifted out of sight. That glimpse of possible rescue filled us with sudden, unearned hope, then plunged us downward into a sharp despair made keener by a growing hunger and thirst. Our talk of water became obsessional, then delusional, until Jordan forbade any of us to mention the subject again. Miraculously, Mike's arm, though set hastily, showed no signs of infection where the broken bone had punctured his flesh. As we floated, we learned that thirst sharpened the edge of nightmare, and that hunger was the perfect entree before hallucination. The heat and sunlight made our dreaming fire-glazed and brittle. At dusk, we awoke drenched in sweat and plunged gratefully into the evening sea, naked alongside the drifting boat. The salt water teased us as we rinsed our mouths out again and again as we swam, spitting the water back into the ocean. As soon as we were back on board, Jordan would give the order to get all the hooks in the water, despite the rancid condition of the bait. Our patience was rewarded on the fifth night when Capers hooked a small amberjack and brought it on board with a shout. Jordan immediately killed the fish, cut it into fresh bait, insisted that all the hooks be rebaited at once. 5 days at sea and one shitty little amberjack, Mike said, disgusted, as I pulled up his hand lines and baited them with the amberjack.
I don't see why we're fishing anyway, Capers added. We can't eat the fish even if we catch 'em.
Yeah, we can, Jordan said, and we will.
You can't eat raw fish, I said.
We're going to eat all the raw fish we catch, and we're going to learn to love it, Jordan said, casting his line again and fishing deep.
It makes me want to throw up just thinking about it, said Capers. I can't do it, Jordan, no matter what you say.
You'll do it when you get hungry enough, or thirsty enough, Jordan assured us.
I've never been able to eat a raw oyster, Mike admitted.
Could you eat one now? Jordan asked.
Mike thought for a moment, then said, Yeah, I could eat 100 of the bastards.
When we were stationed in Japan with my father, my parents were fanatics about raw fish. It's Japan's greatest delicacy. They treat their fish with utter respect, and the man who cuts the fish is considered an artist. But Capers would have no part of it.
You can do a lot of things, Jordan, but you can't make a Jap out of a Middleton.
I bet I can, Jordan said, because after you chew on the raw fish, it's going to quench your thirst. It's the water in the fish that's going to save our lives.
Sucking water out of fish kidneys, I said,
Just what I've always wanted to do. Get your minds ready for it. We've been without water for over 3 whole days. We've already started to die.
Could you phrase it a bit differently? Mike asked.
We're already weakening, Jordan said.
Much better, I said. Be careful how you use the language out here.
I'll be careful about the language, Jordan said, but you boys prepare yourself for a banquet of raw fish.
We put our freshly baited lines over, and I was in mid-reverie when a shout came from Jordan. He had a serious bite on his line, and for 10 minutes he fought and finally landed a 20-pound grouper in the boat. Jordan cut it up carefully and out of view of the rest of us. He waited until it was total darkness before he handed out the glistening strips of grouper to his 3 most reluctant diners. The flesh of the fish was translucent and held its ivory hue even under starlight.
As Jordan ate, relishing each drop of moisture before swallowing, Capers and Mike threw up 2 times, and I 1, before we managed to keep any part of the meal down. The hurdle was psychological, but it was severe. Before the night was over, however, each of us had consumed over 1 pound of raw fish.
Jordan was patient and kept his head. Even when we regurgitated our 1st pieces of fish, he saved that vomited-up fish for bait. That night we caught 14 other fish, and the mood on the boat changed from resignation to resolve. We slept through the hot sun of the next day in the full knowledge that we had placed our trust in a captain who seemed to know what he was doing.
The next day, a freighter passed within 2,000 feet of our boat, but none of us heard anything until Jordan woke up when the wake of the larger ship hit us broadside, and we screamed ourselves hoarse as we watched the ship disappear over the horizon. Still, we drifted south, borne by currents and winds. We talked constantly of rescue, of conversations we would have with our parents, of wrongs we would right back home, and of secrets we had always held close to the chest. Time seemed to lose all meaning as the countless waves slapped against the side of our boat. In one another's haunted faces, we could mark the toll our drifting was taking as we became more and more sunburned and hollow-cheeked, looking for deliverance upon an ocean whose indifference was magisterial, ineffaceable.
We gave up 100 times each day, and then discovered secret deposits of courage that we had not dared imagine. We told jokes, we despaired, we completed each day as we began it, and our discipline held. One day after Capers had washed Mike carefully, and Jordan made him take a few awkward side-stroke laps around the boat for exercise, Mike screamed as I was lifting him into the boat. I thought I had hurt him accidentally, but what had caused the scream was a movement in a sea that had not moved all day. Then I saw it, and Jordan, who was still in the water, saw it too. Capers' back was turned to the fin that was coming swiftly at him from 50 yards away. That fin stood far higher in the water than either Jordan's or Capers' head. "Whale," Mike said, and I wished he had been right. Jordan reached for Capers as Capers spun around to see what Mike was pointing at. The dark water was clear enough in the still, sun-suffused sea for Mike to make the first clear identification of the hammerhead. I remember to this day the terrible left eye of the great fish as it swooped by the boat. Mike saw the jaws open as Capers and Jordan both came thrashing toward us, screaming and absolutely frantic.
"A fucking shark!" Mike said,
and even with a broken arm, he leaned over to help Capers into the boat. But Jordan suddenly stopped. He seemed unable to move or make a decision. Slowly, he began swimming away from the boat, with the 3 of us screaming at him. Mike was the first to spot the fin again, and it was heading toward Jordan with amazing speed. The shark shot through that water like lightning, slicing through a night sky. And this time, Mike glanced down and saw that terrible eye as it passed Jordan's helpless, naked form. Finally, Jordan swam close enough for me to grab him by the wrist. Capers got his other arm, and together we lifted him straight out of that ocean and certain horrible death in which we would have listened to Jordan's screams as he was torn apart in the water beneath us. The fin disappeared and then came around again, charging in full fury, and we watched in awe and terror.
All of us saw the great right eye of the hammerhead count us as we cringed in what safety the boat could provide. That night, all of us wept, even Jordan, and it was good for the rest of us to see Jordan show fear at last.
We hardly moved all night. We listened to the hammerhead circle the boat and bump up against it in frustration. The stillness of the water and the brilliance of a nearly full moon turned that fin coppery as it stalked us. The shark would disappear for an hour or two, then return unbidden and without warning to see if we had made the mistake of entering the water again. "My ass isn't touching water again unless it's a pool full of chlorine or a bathtub with my mother holding my pajamas standing right next to it," Mike said. "What were you thinking when you were swimming toward that fin?" I asked Jordan, who shivered involuntarily before he said, "My body went numb with fear. It was like paralysis, like polio. I think my body was preparing for me to die. I don't know if I'd have felt anything if the shark had torn my leg off."
"You'd have felt something," Capers said. "Jesus, when I think of the teeth on that thing, I close my eyes and all I can think of is that mouth coming up to get you, Jordan."
"It had a set of dentures," I agreed.
"Boys, I want you to look over here at your buddy Mike Hess," said Mike. "Take a good look, because you're never going to see him on a fishing trip again. You're never going to see him eating a fish again. You're never going to see him on a boat again."
We laughed together. Then the shark swept past the boat once more, and its tail slapped against the side of the boat, as though the fish were trying to deliver some dread message to the humans on board. We held our breaths and listened for the fish to make another pass. In our imaginations, 1,000 hammerheads infested the moonlit waters beneath us. The shark was omniscient, omnipresent, insatiable. It hunted us, and only us, in all the cunning of its despised species. It had smelled our bloodstreams as it moved through the bridal veils of Portuguese man-of-wars and the ink clouds of octopuses in full flight. For 3 days, the hammerhead bird-dogged our boat, sometimes disappearing for a half-day at a time, but always reappearing just when we thought we had seen the last of it. Then suddenly it disappeared for good, as a storm rose over the Atlantic. We cheered out loud when we saw the black, furious clouds forming. Our thirst was so acute by that time, we had placed the subject of water off limits again. Our tongues felt black and swollen, as though we had been staked out to dry and packed in salt. And so we obsessively watched every cloud that passed overhead, praying for a thunderhead to form. When the shark disappeared for the last time, heading north, there was lightning in the eastern sky. Normally, we would have feared lightning in an open boat, but now there were cries of joy at the rain it portended. We unfolded the tarp that had been stowed under a seat and took the lid off the pathetically dried-out ice chest. None of us took our eyes off the clouds as the storm gathered slowly. We watched the clouds begin to spiral upward in great, cumulus bursts, as though shaped by magnificent, unseen hands, and we waited, our mouths dry, praying for the abundance of water they would bring to save us. The wind rose, then the waves began to rise, as the tide began its surge and run. Thunder that was miles away was suddenly upon us, and lightning carved its name above us before the rain came in sheets that stung our sunburned faces. Great drops moistened our lips and tongues, and we wept in sheer relief. Jordan screamed for us to keep our discipline, and we held the tarpaulin loosely as rain filled its sagging middle with gallons of water. Together, we moved as one and made a funnel, then poured the streaming water into the ice chest. Again, Jordan called for us to catch more rainwater, but the three of us had thrown ourselves at the ice chest and were filling Dixie cups and drinking ravenously. Then Jordan, too, lost control and joined us in that feast of fresh water. Its bright elixir brought our voices back as we drank our fill and rejoiced with the thunder. When we had drunk all we had collected, once more we spread the tarp to catch the precious water, filling the ice chest again to its capacity. As the storm worsened and the winds rose, a new fear began to fray the edges of our consciousness. Though we had prayed for rain and storm, we had said nothing of wind, nor even thought of it. There was no moon or stars, and as waves began to crash over the sides of the boat, we secured the ice chest and went to our appointed places. The waves began to build, looming above us, then dropping out from under the boat like hills dropped into the sea. Though the craft was seaworthy, we could not steer it into the waves and had to ride out the storm, bobbing like a pelican between the enormous troughs. As the weight of one wave crashed over us, I was almost carried overboard. It caught me holding tightly to the stern of the boat and carried me, choking on seawater, into the gunwale. Another wave broke the ice chest loose and sent it overboard with a tackle box that had not been tied down after its last use. At Jordan's command, we tightened the circles of our life jackets as he handed each of us lengths of rope so we could tie ourselves into the boat. We heard Mike get tossed head over heels, and Jordan reached out and grabbed his bathing suit as Mike somersaulted backward and broke his arm again against the steering wheel. The water of the great waves broke over us, and lightning flashed to the west now as the storm moved on. Nature could answer one's prayer far too well as our boat, fragile as a leaf, floated in the utter blackness of 30-foot seas, and the night made us afraid to pray for rain with too much conviction. In the morning, we woke to a foundering boat more than half filled with water. Jordan and I spent that morning bailing out water with our hands. Almost everything else had been washed overboard. Mike was moaning and barely conscious, and we were afraid to touch the newly broken arm. Soon, infection would begin to set in, and there was nothing any of us could do about it. Capers had endured another blow to his head, and a flap of his scalp opened up to reveal the whiteness of his skull. He was unconscious. Jordan and I had broken ribs during the night, and it hurt both of us to breathe. We cleared the boat of water until exhaustion overtook us, and we slept a deep sleep of both pain and despair. Another night passed, and another day, then another night. Then day again, and the sun began its work in earnest, and we were too weak to hide from it. Now the terrible burning started, and somewhere in the middle of the next day, we began to die. Our feet swelled, and blisters began to form on our hands and faces. We lost all sense of time or space, or sense of where we might be on the planet. And the thought of death was not unpleasant to me. Jordan had become feverish, and one night reached out his hand to me.
"Hey, Tonto," Jordan said, "it looks like the bad guys win."
"We gave it a hell of a run, Kemosabe," I whispered.
"To tell the truth," said Jordan, "I wish I hadn't come on this fishing trip."
I laughed, but even laughter hurt.
"Jack, can you hear me?"
"Yeah."
"Are we the only ones alive?"
"We're the only ones conscious," I said. "I envy those guys."
"The two Catholic boys," said Jordan.
"Yeah, lucky us."
"Let's say the rosary," Jordan said. "Let's put our lives in the hands of the Virgin Mary."
"I'll put my life in the hands of Zeus if it'll help."
"If it works, Jack, we'll owe our whole lives to her."
"I'm the only one in this boat who isn't crazy," I whispered to myself.
"Promise you'll dedicate your life to the Virgin Mary and to her son Jesus if we survive this?" Jordan asked.
"Have you lost your mind?" I asked.
I remember hearing Jordan begin the Apostles' Creed, then the sun again, then stars, then nothing, then stars again, then nothing, then nothing. Then fog and movement. I woke up having no idea if I was alive or dead.
"Get up, Jack," I heard Jordan say. "I need you. Get up now."
I rose, staggering. In the back of the boat, I saw Jordan with a broken paddle, digging at the water, grimacing every time the boat moved even a little bit.
"Do you hear something?"
I stepped over the bodies of our two friends. They were still breathing, but both looked dead. The fog was another form of blindness. I felt submerged in a river of milk. It was bright with false morning light, and I could see nothing except my hand in front of me.
"Get on the bow," Jordan urged. "Do you hear it? Tell me if you hear it too."
I closed my eyes and concentrated on the sheer astonishment of being alive and being asked to listen. For a moment, I wondered if we were all dead and fog was the natural landscape when the last breath had been drawn.
"I hear it," I said suddenly. "I hear it. It's surf, the sound of waves crashing on the beach."
"Not that," Jordan said. "There's something in the water, something alive."
Then I heard the other sound, the unworldly sound that had no connection to where we were or to the ocean. It sounded like an engine or a bellows or something hissing and exhausted somewhere near us in the fog. The sound grew closer until I thought it was a man dying in the water just beyond my reach. But then I realized it was not human, and I drew back, thinking of the migration of humpback whales along the coast,
feeling vulnerable as I lay on the bow, my arms extended over it. My ribs were afire, and the thing in the water made me afraid, yet I was more fearful of letting Jordan down. The sound of surf, I suddenly realized, was the sound of rescue and salvation. Then I saw it coming directly toward me, as disoriented as I myself was, as displaced, as drawn away from his own element as I. But I reached out toward him and touched something that connected me solidly and completely to my own history, to my boyhood in the marshes and fields of the Carolinas. A white-tailed buck, as large and powerful as any I had ever seen, was swimming to a new home between islands. I had seen a buck do it once before in my life, and I grabbed hold of the left antler and felt my fingers lock around it. The buck's great muscled neck tried to loose itself from my grip, but I held that spiked bone tightly, and I felt the boat turn with the rhythm of the swimming deer. The buck was in the deep water of a channel, and the tide was going in. The deer finally gave up its own direction, and just swam to save itself, and took us with him. From the stern, Jordan paddled as hard as he could, trying to help the deer.